listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 20th installment in our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR from the revolution in 1917 until 1991. Luciana, we missed you last week, and we're glad you're back.
Thank you, Don. Glad to be back.
So we are going to try to wrap up the Spanish Civil War. I think we've given it a good amount of scrutiny, the role of the USSR in that in particular, and the various trends that were trending inside the CPSU at the time, and so let's start there.
Okay. So the question that I have in mind for today to explore is this. Did the Soviet Union advocate a popular front in Spain to preserve capitalism and make the liberal democracies happy, as Trotsky argued, or was it a realistic strategy to fight fascism?
Right.
So, to summarize some of Trotsky's claim that we've mentioned, but I'll just put them all in a bundle. Trotsky said things like, defense of Spanish Republic is defense of capitalism, meaning that the fight against Franco should become a social revolution. That is, a civil war within a civil war, a civil war within the Republican side. We've talked about this. Is that? And then he said, the Popular Front curbed social revolution in Spain. He said that social revolution in Spain would have triggered social revolution in Europe and would have crushed Hitler and fascism. He said that Stalin had been Franco's best ally. He said that the Soviet bureaucracy, and this is, he said some contradictory things, that the Soviet bureaucracy, he said, on the one hand, he said, well, had wanted to extend influence on Spain, but at the same, in other parts, he claimed that the USSR wanted to keep socialism in one country, so which is it?
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting little angle. But, yeah. You know, Stalin discusses socialism in one country as in, well, the world revolution hasn't happened, so we have a choice before us. Do we just become another bourgeois state and wait until the world revolution comes, or do we build socialism in one country? And from that, Trotsky imputes to Stalin the intent to lock socialism up inside the USSR and not let it escape.
Exactly.
It's insane,
exactly.
Really.
And what Stalin said, you know, we have two-thirds of the world. Well, we're one. Remember that figure? We are one... sixth of the world, and yeah, we have all these
other,
the rest of the world against us. Sure. And finally, Trotsky concluded in 1939 that, and I have quoted this already, but it's worth quoting again, that the inspirer of deceit and of the massacre of the revolutionary workers of Spain was Stalin. The defeat of the Spanish Revolution falls as a new indelible blot upon the already bespattered Kremlin gang.
Mm.
This was in 1939.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and we know what's coming. I mean, we know that, you know, looming in the, well, 1939, we have the... non-aggression pact with Germany that was signed by the USSR because it knew German aggression was coming. Hitler was not shy about announcing who the enemy was long before he came to power, even.
Oh, yes.
As soon as they could build and array the weaponry, they deployed them and sent them charging through Poland into the USSR, leaving almost 30 million dead behind. So there was no secret that that was coming. And in 1939, they saw that it was coming, and that's the context that the Kremlin saw things inside. And as it turns out, having defeated Hitler, looking, you know, in retrospect, they were right.
Yeah, they were. So, you know, we could argue that from, in retrospect, but even from that point of view, that you first had to defeat fascism and then think about the revolution, the social revolution, and, right, and that the united front was a realistic option. And besides, which, you know, Trotsky criticized that that the USSR imposed on the Spanish the Civil War on the Republican side, the tasks that were purely democratic and not socialist. But this wasn't, this was not contrary to the interest of the Soviets, which had for the time being a scope of keeping good reports.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also tied to the risk it saw that Spain, a red Spain, would run before the almost inevitable Anglo-American reaction and the doddering of the French connivance.
Right. France was, you know, the Vichy was waiting in the wings at that point in time, right? And Hitler was lining up along the cartoon version of the Maginot Line, and France was about to become, in essence, the western provinces of Germany, and Spain is next. So a red Spain would certainly incite Hitler, and as a matter of fact, Hitler dove into the Spanish Civil War with both feet, right?
Yeah, and so would the the liberal democracies would be upset. Britain. Yep. And the United States.
Which was interesting because they weren't upset enough about the prospect of a fascist Spain
to do
anything about it. They were, you know, watching that from afar. But a red Spain, oh my God.
Yeah, they were neutral in the Spanish Civil War while Hitler was crossing the Mediterranean back and forth, supplying weapons and the airspace, etc. That was their neutrality.
Well, like Howard Zinn says, of course, there's no standing still on a moving train. Their neutrality was, in fact, support for fascism.
Yeah. So I just want to quote Stalin's view of Trotskyism in 1939, So he reported to the Central Committee in 1939, and he's very stern. He reminds them that they had ignored the internal subversion. So he says, our party comrades failed to notice, overlooked, that present-day Trotskyism is not what it was. Let us say 7 or 8 years ago, the Trotskyism and the Trotskyists have, during this time, undergone a serious evolution which has radically altered the face of Trotskyism. That in view of this, in the struggle against Trotskyism, the method of struggle likewise must be radically altered. Our party comrades have failed to notice that Trotskyism has ceased to be a political tendency within the working class. Trotskyism has transformed into a frenzied and unprincipled band of wreckers, diversionists, spies, and killers, acting upon the instructions of the intelligence services, service organs of foreign states. This, in the Western propaganda, is an example of Stalin's paranoia, fear of plots, etc. But was he justified?
Let's go back to Lenin for a minute, because Lenin had some interesting things to say also. here's one quote. Trotsky's never held yet a firm opinion on any important question of Marxism. He always contrives to worm his way into the cracks of any given difference of opinion and deserts one side for the other. At the present moment, he's in the company of the Bundists and the Liquidators, and these gentlemen do not stand on ceremony where the party's concerned. That's one. He goes with the breeze. Another, he calls him a despicable careerist and a factionalist of the Ryazanov and company type. And other places, things that are worse. He says, in essence, that he's a rogue, that he's no good. He's a crook, dishonest, and he's in the pocket of or in bed with the capitalists, all over the places.
Yeah.
This is Lenin. This is before Stalin.
And Trotsky and the Trotskyists call themselves Marxist-Leninists.
Right. That's right. They do, and they'll say that Stalin perverted Lenin and that Trotsky was the true Leninist and Lenin's best pal.
Yeah. I'm going to get to another quote, an interesting quote by Lenin, but in the meantime, I want to say what the Trotskyist view today is on the Spanish Civil War and on the role of the Soviet Union in the Spanish Civil War. He said that the goal, the secret design of Stalin in Spain was not to permit the Republic to be definitively defeated and at the same time not to help it to win. And this...
That's interesting,
because
isn't it?
Stalin was considering the possibility of an alliance with Germany. You tell me how that follows.
Right.
For an example, often is given this this particular thing. For example, the Minister of Defense, Prieto, actually proposed to attack the ships, the German ships, in the waters of the Mediterranean. And this proposal was rejected by Moscow as a provocation.
Right.
Right. Well, which it would have been.
Of course it would. There was... Yeah, go ahead. I'm not going to elaborate on... Yes. Hi, yeah. I'm going to attack you. That's going to provoke a response, period. If you happen to be someone who came to power promising my death, I've just opened the door for you to do that.
Yeah, yeah, come on, come right in. So I don't know whose actual suggestion was to do this crazy thing, the historian Hugh Thomas actually includes... who did the history of the Spanish Civil War, sort of a classic.
Right.
So Thomas says that Prieto proposed that the Republic bomb all the German ships that were crossing the Mediterranean. He realizes that this could provoke a world war. Nevertheless, he says that that the risk is necessary because only in this way will the German aid to Franco end. Now, the representatives of the Comintern in Spain were absolutely stupefied. They consulted Moscow, and Stalin answered that the Soviet government did not desire a world war.
Right. Stalin's whole thing was essentially, look, war is coming, if it comes, but we believe war is coming. We are preparing for it, and the more time we have to prepare for it, the better we shall do. And so, if we can avoid war until the very last, it's to our advantage. And that was the game that they played, and that's what won, as it turned out.
Yes, and especially not to provoke this, you know, not to give Hitler a reason to act before they were ready, as you said. Yes.
Right. I mean, look, if I'm trying to not have a war until I'm ready, and if I'm not ready, why exactly would I attack the other side? I mean,
and why would I take on the burden of being accused of being the aggressor?
Yeah, well, you've got all that whole public relations problem to deal with, of course, which matters some. But then you've got the material aspect. Do I have enough planes and tanks yet? Or are they still on the assembly line? Are they still under construction? And those are the questions that Stalin was focused on, and that's the work that was being done in the factories, and there was a war there. You had people, industrial sabotage going on in those factories. You had German agents and some say other Western agents that were sabotaging the ability to produce weapons for self-defense.
Yes, they had done so from 1934 on.
Yep. And so, you know, in that environment, it's actually, you know, operating should have to file as a foreign agent to advocate to provoke the enemy before you're ready.
Yes. Just madness, yeah.
Yep.
Well, and I also want to quote a 1936 telegram that Stalin sent to Spain, very terse, very simple, that sort of is a good contrast to the verbosity and the exultation of the other one, Trotsky. He simply wrote, "The workers of the Soviet Union are merely carrying out their duty in giving help within their power to the revolutionary masses of Spain." He calls them revolutionary masses of Spain. They are aware, the workers of the Soviet Union are aware that the liberation of Spain from the yoke of fascist reactionary is not a private affair of the Spanish people, but the common cause of the whole of advanced and progressive mankind. Fraternal greetings, J. Stalin, Pravda, 16 October 1936. Now, this Trotsky reverses completely, you know, that they are aware that the liberation of Spain from the yoke of fascism is the affair not only of the Spanish people, but the common cause. No, no, that was reversed into, well, this is purely interests of Stalin and the bureaucracy. So that sort of, that terse note gives you the tone of one versus the other, of Stalin versus the rantings, really, of Trotsky.
Right.
Now, what have communist leaders who actually conducted revolution, successfully conducted revolution, what opinion do they have of Trotsky?
That's an interesting question. In other words, forgetting for a moment the very important opinion of those sitting in an armchair in bourgeois heaven in one place or another as to what they think should be the path to be followed by people whose lives are so tentative, so in jeopardy, so uncomfortable that they've chosen revolution as a course of action. What do those fine gentlemen think these people should do to remedy their problem, as opposed to people who have actually done it?
Done it. That's right. I mean, you can't really criticize a revolution you have never conducted, can
That's
you?
Right. Well, so, it doesn't seem to stop them, but correct. That would be my understanding of it, yes.
Mm-hmm. So you already mentioned Lenin. He published a book in two volumes, dedicated to Trotsky's attack against the Bolshevik Party. He had a thing about the Bolshevik Party, Trotsky did. And I want to add, before I quote, that his idea of the people was an idea, was, and I think you could call it an idealization of the people, and this, he presumed that there was an instinct in people to be revolutionary without the guidance of a party. It's what I, you know, it's as if he believed socialism is an instinct, whereas, as we know from the Soviet Union and we know from Cuba, socialism is an education. There may be an instinct for justice, that's just general in the human species, but you have to be educated to the thought of socialism, and that's why you need an instruction body, you know. But he was against that. I mean, I remember an incident that Fidel talked about. I don't remember where or when, long time ago. He went into the streets after the 1959 revolution and asked people if they wanted housing, affordable housing, free medical care, free education. They all said, oh, yeah. Well, how about socialism? Socialism? Oh, no, not socialism.
Yeah, it's funny.
So,
yeah.
That's what I mean by you may have an instinct for justice, for social justice, but that instinct doesn't get developed except by education. You know, you have to have that.
Right.
You have to be educated.
This is the ideological question. This is where ideology is, in fact, important. And,
yeah,
you know, people worship it as if it were, you know, a religion almost or something. But what we're talking about is if you are trying to achieve some outcome in the material world, having a scientific approach to obtaining it is absolutely necessary. And
Yeah. That's
true even in politics, and perhaps especially in politics. And that is exactly what we're talking about here, is something that you've been trained as an ideology is bad, evil, or whatever, if that happens to be the only material route to obtaining justice, Shouldn't that be the thing that's pursued? And this is a, you know, sort of the conundrum that we find ourselves in, because people have been brainwashed to be afraid of socialism. And we're seeing that, however, sort of shaking loose here, if nothing else. You know, the word itself no longer carries the, you know, the ideological weight in opposition, perhaps, that it used to. It's not like a tick, like in Tourette's or something anymore. And
right.
I remember when Obama was running, and every time somebody called him a socialist, he went up in the polls, even though he had nothing to do with socialism. That was a unique condition post, like, 1949 or something in this country. And certainly, when you saw the idea of class coming front and center back in 2011, certainly, even if not in 1999, but with the rise of Occupy Wall Street, where the 1% and the 99% as two distinct and, you know, hostile groups comes front and center to the social, you know, that this is the main contradiction that has to be resolved. That is class consciousness percolating to the top in a place where it had been smothered for 50 years.
That's right.
So
it no longer causes panic, the word,
right,
except among older generation, I think, comfortable, liberal.
Well, some of these libertarians, the young ones, like the out of the millennials, some of the libertarians say some things also that seem, you know, I don't want to get clinical, so I won't say paranoid psychosis, but that seem you know, like a knee-jerk reaction to something that they apparently don't understand.
Yeah, that's very strange.
Yeah, but outside of that, I think that there's been a sea change on this question. So anyway, we're getting close to. I think we've got about 6 minutes left, so go ahead.
Oh, okay.
And go ahead.
I'll proceed with the quotes of the people who actually conducted revolution. So, in 1916, that would be a year before Trotsky joined the Bolsheviks. He joined the Bolsheviks in August of 1917, when you know, the tide turned against the Mensheviks, etc.
Mm.
So, in 1916, Lenin wrote, Trotsky is a manipulator, a liar, and a cynic. In his turbulent political career, he moved from the socialist revolutionaries to the Menshevik, but he has not, and to this day he has not changed. He is a fervent enemy and critic of the Bolshevik Party. He opposes himself in every occasion. This is Trotsky. He has attitudes of the left, but positions of the right.
Right. Yep.
That's 1916.
Yep.
Why they let him in is beyond my comprehension.
And to really appreciate that, folks should read, for example, What is to be Done, that pamphlet that Lenin wrote, where and in other places where Lenin really parses the various parties and forces that were, you know, at play in both the February Revolution in 1917, the opposition to the October Revolution, and then the continuing struggle for at least a short while after that. And the SRs, as they were called, the Socialist Revolutionary Party, was one of the, you know, essentially one of the agents of reaction that was the most, one of the most significant. They, like Trotsky, clothed themselves in hyper-revolutionary garb, and yet the steps that were being advocated were in opposition to the things that clearly needed to be done to get from here to there. And Trotsky rode that horse as long as he could, then the Mensheviks for as long as that could, then he joins the Bolsheviks when they win and starts criticizing everything that they do. You know, from that moment forward until finally he ends up in front of HUAC, by the way. People don't know that. He ends up testifying against the Soviet Union in front of Dees at HUAC in the 1940s.
That's right. Yeah. Now, in Peru, where there hasn't been a revolution, but there has been, you know, movements,
anti-capitalist
movement. The founder of a communist party in Peru, José Carlos Mariátegui, said something interesting, too. He said, Trotskyism feels like a radical theory, but it is unable to condense them in concrete and precise formulae. That is, you know, it has a radical theory which it has no way of conducting to praxis, to practice.
Right.
Then again, in Catalonia, the Socialist Party gathered four left parties together, unified them, excluding the Communist Party, which had its own party, and it excluded excluded the Trotskyist. The Trotskyists launched a permanent program of propaganda against the Spanish Communist Party and the Spanish Socialist Party.
Right.
Now, we have to realize that there were 3,000 Trotskyists in the whole Spanish War, and there were 4.5 million members in the Communist Party, 400,000 in the Socialist, and about 50,000 in the Basque Communist Party. So we're looking at 3,000 that were supposed to.
Yeah, we're looking at outliers as opposed to the heart and soul of the socialist revolution. And we got to stop here today. Next week we can finish up the Spanish Civil War because we're poised to do that now. And also delve a little more deeply into this whole, Trotskyist phenomenon. So thank you, Professor Bone. I really appreciate the fact that you've been giving us the time to do this. We have a lot more ahead of us, and I hope that people are finding it valuable, and I know I am. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Don. Until next week.
Until next week. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Give me a lever and a fulcrum and I shall move the world. Almost every politician in this day and age uses some rendition of the Archimedes Pledge in search of power, but very few deliver after gaining it. Is that due to the lack of striving or perhaps striving for all the wrong things? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Eric Muskin, American economist and 2007 Nobel laureate. Professor Muskin, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for sparing some time for us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Now, you're best known for mechanism design theory. You got your Nobel Prize for it. And as far as I understand, it's a bit like reverse engineering. You start out with a goal you want to achieve and you work backwards. And I can see how it can be easily applied to electoral politics, running for office. But is it just as applicable to running the office, governance, which by definition is far more diffused when it comes to the stated goals?
Yes, well, I think mechanism design comes into politics first in the design of governments. When a country is trying to figure out how it is going to allocate power to the executive, to the legislative, it will draw up a constitution. And the process of designing and executing a constitution is an exercise in mechanism design.
But I assume the challenge here would be not only defining and sort of operationalizing your goals, but also prioritizing them. And as much as you want to bring more mathematics and science into governance, do you think it's actually possible, realistic, to construct that multi-layered governing algorithm when you're so constrained by a short political cycle?
Mechanism design is more concerned with what constraints you place on politicians, on officials, what scope for the exercise of power they have. Once they're in office, it's up to them to operate within those constraints. That is, mechanism design doesn't tell them what they should do in office.
It's interesting that you stress the sort of limiting part, and I think that's actually a very cultural American thing about the idea about limiting power. But obviously when a politician or like a new government comes into office, it also needs a certain freedom to execute its own policies. How would you balance those out?
That's where constraints on what a particular official can do come in. For example, under the American system, the government is not allowed to tell a newspaper not to write on a subject unless it can be argued that national security will be jeopardized immediately. And that's a very difficult argument to make. They're free to tell the newspaper or TV station that they don't like what the journalists are doing, but they can't stop them.
It's interesting that you again bring in this example of media, because I think that's a particular American hang-up, because governance is not about what the media is writing or not writing about this or that particular government. Don't you actually think that in the United States, the whole conversation about governance is now reduced to how the government relates to the media?
Oh, but the media play an essential role in American politics, because it's very difficult for government to monitor itself.
But don't you think that actually substitutes governance for politics? Because when you cover the government's actions only from that political and sometimes very partisan point of view, do you actually have enough capacity, both as media and as government, to pursue, you know, policies that actually matter for people in their daily lives, like healthcare, education, and so on and so forth? Because to be honest with you, I haven't seen that much coverage of those essential issues in the American media. It's all about Trump these days, but very little about the substantive questions.
Well, if you look at the coverage of the recent tax bill, you'll see quite a lot of substance in press coverage. Who will be affected by the tax cuts, whether this will stimulate growth, whether it will cause American companies to repatriate their assets. All of this is covered in the press, and a good thing too, because that's how the public finds out what's actually in the tax bill.
Now, you also contribute to that discussion, because earlier this year you co-authored an article suggesting swapping the current plurality rule for a majority rule in presidential elections, saying that after 224 years, perhaps, quote, it's time to change the rules of the game. Why now?
Well, only because we saw in what happens in last year's election some particularly bad flaws in the current system. Just to give an example, in the Republican primary elections, there were initially 16 candidates running. One of those candidates was Donald Trump, and Trump benefited very much from the existing plurality rule system because he was so different from the other candidates. If you took any one of those mainstream candidates and you put him in a head-to-head contest with Trump, that other candidate might well have won. Mm-hmm. But because the support for the mainstream was divided over so many different candidates, all those candidates ended up losing to Trump. Trump had a plurality of the vote, even though he didn't have a majority. And so it can be argued there would have been other candidates who would have actually been supported more widely by Republican voters than than by Trump.
Now, I understand that you view Trump as somebody who's unequivocally bad for the American system, but what makes you actually believe that? Because you've argued before in favor of mainstream candidates.
No.
And, you know, on a personal level, it's easy to relate to that when you see some of the tweets and the statements that the current president of the United States has made. But on a policy level, when you actually analyze what he has done and what other mainstream mm-hmm. candidates in the American political system have done, is there an argument that he is actually, scientific argument, that he is so much worse than all the other mainstream candidates?
I think there is. If you look at his so-called policy proposals, many of them are incoherent. For example, Trump came into office with a pledge that he was going to reform the healthcare system. But once he was in office, he did nothing of the kind. He spent his first few months trying to tear down the current system, the system that was created by his predecessor, President Obama, but he did nothing at all to try to put something in its place.
And that was possibly because he also faced certain opposition from Congress and from larger American electorate. But
he didn't even say what he was going to put in its place. That's the point. It was not a well-thought-out policy.
Well, I may agree with you on that point, that it was not a well-thought-out policy, but there have been a number of American presidents or presidential candidates before who didn't come to office saying that, for example, they are going to launch a war in Iraq or an
right.
invasion or an attack on Libya, and they
right.
actually did. So
yes.
when you compare the damage of those not even suggested
no.
policies to what he's been proposing but hasn't been able to realize, is he, again, really so much worse than the others?
Oh, as far as what he's actually done so far, I don't think he's been as damaging, for example, as George W. Bush. I'm judging him primarily on his plans. He looks one step ahead, whereas to formulate sensible policies, you have to look five steps ahead. He's not one for following the consequences of his policy changes forward in time sufficiently.
But with all due respect, I know this station RT that I represent here is often accused of being very hostile to his presidential competitor, Ms. Clinton, but when we look back at her policy in Libya, you cannot make an argument that it was really thought through. I'm not arguing in favor of one or the other, but again, I'm interested from the structural analysis point of view.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the American system, to expand a little bit on that, is a very peculiar system. It's not the first time that, for example, the Electoral College has produced a different outcome from the popular vote. There has been numerous...
It happened twice in 17 years.
Absolutely. Right? Then there is gerrymandering, which is, I think, is an example of malicious mechanism design.
Yep.
And yet none of those structural issues have rattled the American political elites to quite the same extent as Trump's personality does. Is it really a rational approach to politics?
I think you're right that there probably has been an overreaction to Trump's personality, to the tweets. At the same time, we haven't had a president before who has been quite so dishonest as Trump, who has said so many things which are in obvious contradiction to the fact. On his very first day in office, he claimed that the size of the audience at his inauguration was the largest ever. Now, of course, this is not a very important issue, but the fact that he made this claim, and it was so easy to check that it was false, got his presidency off to a really bad start. Has the press focused on these small details too much? Probably yes. But still, it's unusual to have a president who is so dishonest.
Well, I agree with you that it's unusual. And certainly there have been American presidents who lied before. They were just better at covering it. But at the end of the day,
I don't think they lied as much. If they lied, there was perhaps some way, at least to themselves, of justifying the lie.
Well, I'm sure Trump can justify it to himself. But I guess the question I want to ask is whether, whatever you think about Trump personally, whether there is still a learning value from his presidency, in a sense that, you know, politics may be very susceptible to mechanism design, but life is not. Yeah. Life is an open-ended experiment.
Right.
Isn't there a learning value, immunity strengthening value in having somebody like Trump, because it energizes your society to an extent that makes you stronger. No?
That's right. So American government acts on what we call the principle of checks and balances. And one thing that we are testing in the Trump presidency is the ability of other parts of government to limit the power of the president. And that's useful. It's not always painless.
But that life never is.
But it is useful in the same way that when Richard Nixon was president, it was useful to see that the government was able to effectively remove him from office without there being a coup.
Well, Professor Maskin, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Eric Maskin, an American economist and a 2007 Nobel Prize laureate. Professor Maskin, we talked about the United States. Now let's talk about Russia. Russia has a fundamentally different system with far less constraints on the government and especially on the executive. And I think the biggest challenge here is finding a balance between social stability and economic development, because you can easily have one without another. You can have, you know, development without stability or stability without development. But combining the two has been a major challenge for this country, and I think it resulted in a prolonged stagnation. From the point of view of the theory that you pioneered, do you have any solutions?
Well, I think one reason why Russia has found it so difficult to develop economically is that it hasn't found a way yet of limiting the power of the executive. If I'm a foreign investor and I'm thinking of putting my money into Russia, under the current system, I might worry that my assets will be expropriated. I might worry that I personally, if I say something that displeases the leadership, that I will be thrown in jail. One way of preventing that sort of thing from happening is to give independent power to a court system, a different branch, an independent branch of government.
It's an interesting comment, and to be honest with you, I think when you're a foreign investor, especially in the current climate, the Russian government will be very protective of you, but I think it is for the local businesses that is much more difficult to defend their interests, including in the court system. And here I would take an issue with your comment, because you said that the government should give power. And in Russia, there has been a number of attempts to reform the court system. But the problem is that it's not just the government, but many other actors, economic actors, who find their ways of manipulating the court system. So I guess the question I'm asking is whether it is really so easy to give power to somebody as opposed to the society actually developing that muscle to claim that power. Because in Russia, you know, there is not the very long tradition of private responsibility, personal initiative, and that is something that obviously benefits the Kremlin. But is it fair to limit Russia only to the omnipowerful Kremlin and everybody else?
I would say relative to a system which would produce better economic development, the Kremlin has too much power. If we look back at European history, if we look back at the history of England, for example, when did England first start developing into an economic power? It was when the king was able to give up some of his power so that investors, the entrepreneurs of that time, were willing to take the risk of investing.
But Mr. Moskin, I think that's, again, a very relevant example, but I'm not sure how applicable it is, because both the United Kingdom and the United States, to a large extent, had the luxury of developing at their own pace. It was an evolutionary development, whereas sure. In many other countries, including Russia, they are sort of having to catch up. They have to declare democracy first and then try to fill in their institutions with substance. And
yes.
That is actually reverse engineering in practice. But don't you think that it creates a sort of different challenges from the ones that the United States and the UK experience?
So you're right that England's and, well, England rather than the United States. United States wrote a constitution where they, in effect, learned from the mistakes that were made in England about how to divide up power so that it wasn't all concentrated in one place. But you're right. In the case of England, it happened in a slow evolutionary way. But there are modern examples, contemporary examples of countries which have successfully made a transition from a dictatorship, if you like, to a well-functioning democracy. Look at South Korea.
But it also took an authoritarian government to do that.
Yes, but the authoritarian government voluntarily gave up a great deal of its power.
Interesting enough, I think that is actually the crossroads that Russia finds itself at the moment, because having a passive society is very convenient when you have short-term goals, when you are only interested in staying in power. But when you have an ambition of great power, self-sustaining great power with a rebellious geopolitical agenda,
yeah.
You actually need a strong society.
You do.
And I think the problem with the Russian leadership right now is that it realizes that, but it is very apprehensive of letting the Russian society to make its own mistakes. And by the way,
right.
Trump's example is not very inspiring here, because nobody in Russia wants to see, or in the Kremlin wants to see a person like Trump winning the elections. How would you navigate this very precarious process of, or precarious needs, various goals of, on the one hand, having to let your society grow and mature, even by making mistakes, and then exercising enough responsibility and leadership to prevent the worst mm-hmm. from happening?
Well, I think one way of moving toward the goal of a more engaged society is through the educational system. I think one thing that more universities can do, the higher school is trying to do this, is to teach students not just the conventional curriculum, but how economics and politics do and could interact in a well-functioning society.
You know, the Soviet Union also had a great educational system, and even higher institutions, despite having an extensive curriculum in Marxism-Leninism, they actually had pretty solid fundamental expertise on sciences, social scientists, mathematics, physics, and so on and so forth. But I think the perennial problem of Russia is translating that extensive knowledge into practical outcome, making that knowledge work.
Yes.
And
So the Soviet Union was great at technical knowledge. They produced great mathematicians, great physicists, not such great social scientists, I would say.
Well, if you make a case that communism was a constructed reality, then it lasted for 70 years. And I think they, you know, given that it lasted for so long, perhaps so, it required some knowledge. The economics wasn't very good because at the end of the day, that brought an end to it.
That's right. Well, one of the things that the higher school of economics is now trying to promote is the idea of entrepreneurship. Perhaps an entrepreneur doesn't invent new technology or new products, but an entrepreneur knows how to assemble new developments in technology and in business to offer something new to consumers. That's a way of thinking that's largely absent, I think, in Russian business. Entrepreneurship is something that the educational system in Russia could promote, and with entrepreneurs and with citizens thinking creatively about their societies and their economies, you have the possibility of an engaged public and the sort of devolution of power that we were discussing earlier becomes more practical.
I actually agree with you, and I would even expand that, because I think in Russia, entrepreneurship is highly vital for developing that social engagement muscle that is very weak in this society. And I'm not quite sure that even the government and President Putin just the other day announced that Russia has actually a goal of increasing the share of small-sized businesses to somewhat around 30 to 40% within the next few decades, which is a commendable goal. But I'm not quite sure that the government has that capacity and the expertise of how to develop that. Do you think perhaps foreign countries could help?
It's up to government to provide the conditions under which new business can create itself. So, for example, from my discussions with people in business in Russia, I have the impression that to set up a new business now involves a huge amount of bureaucratic red tape.
Well, I think this is not exactly accurate, because in the rating of Russia of doing business, Russia has actually advanced quite a bit. So setting up a business is not an issue. It's running the business that is far more difficult because of corruption and the red tape and everything that takes. But setting up a firm is fairly easy.
That's not the impression I have. And even if Russia has advanced on the tables of ease of doing business, it still has a long way to go to be competitive with economies in Europe and North America.
Absolutely. I guess my question was whether you think that the Russian government, in trying to present a good face abroad, may be paying attention to appearances much more than to substance, because whether it takes you 60 days or, let's say, 90 days to set up your business is not really irrelevant compared to what kind of environment that business will be run in. And that kind of environment, addressing that kind of environment, I assume would take a far deeper effort.
Indeed. One of the things that Russian business lacks at the moment is a labor force with the skills needed to undertake the tasks of a modern economy. As we were discussing before, the Russian educational system in many ways is impressive, and it produces great mathematicians and great physicists. What it doesn't do very well is to produce a labor force that is well suited to modern business needs. That is the sort of thing that government can assist with.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. It's been a very interesting conversation for me. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And to our viewers, please share your comments now on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube pages. And I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.